Eric Shinseki falls on his sword. Today, Friday, May 30th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The head of the troubled Department of Veterans Affairs apologizes and resigns.
The pressure, the heat, the politics of this recent veterans scandal just was too much to bear.
We'll look back on General Shinseki's decorated career and ask what this chapter will do to his reputation. Also today, a hit Bollywood movie that sends a positive message to women in India.
The ending is telling us that we are free to do whatever we want, but we need to realize we have the right to freedom.
Plus, why the singer from Iceland decided to record an album twice, first in Icelandic and then 2 years later in English.
It's not usual, but we wanted to try to get it out of Iceland, and we were just so lucky that the labels showed this interest and wanted to help us.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We have a lot of news to cover today, but we've got to start with a story that's just so important to the men and women who do the heavy lifting to protect America's interests around the globe. I'm speaking of the military. This morning, they heard these words from the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Eric Shinseki.
I extend an apology to the people whom I care most deeply about, and that's the veterans of this great country, to their families and loved ones whom I have been honored to serve.
Shinseki was taking responsibility there for the scandal over delayed access to medical care for military veterans. Shortly after, Secretary Shinseki, or Rick as he's also known, met with President Obama. And later the president appeared at the podium in the White House briefing room.
This morning I think some of you also heard Rick take a truly remarkable action. In public remarks, he took responsibility for the conduct of those facilities and apologized to his fellow veterans and to the American people. And a few minutes ago, Secretary Shinseki offered me his own resignation. With considerable regret, I accepted.
Brian Bender covers the national security beat for the Boston Globe. I mean, some people in Washington, Brian, thought this wouldn't bring Shinseki down, this scandal at the VA. What happened?
Well, I think just the pressure, the heat, the politics of this recent veterans scandal just was too much to bear. I think if someone else had had that job, they may have resigned or they may have been relieved earlier than Eric Shinseki. But I think Republicans and Democrats have enormous respect for this guy who has given his entire adult life to public service, first as an Army officer and now as a veterans secretary for 5 years, which is longer than anyone else. And so while there's a lot of respect for him, I think just the information that's been coming out, sort of piling up by the day about waiting lists and misconduct and mismanagement at the VA on his watch, it just got to the point where it was just sort of the water came over the dam.
Right. I mean, it was these doctor visit backlogs for vets that led to Shinseki's fall. Obama appointed him in 2008, right before his first term started. Why do you think Obama chose him to head up the VA in the first place?
The choice of Shinseki at the time was seen by many not simply as a retired general with a lot of respect and management skills who could take on this big task, but it was also kind of a poke in the eye by Obama to the previous administration. When General Shinseki was the Army Chief of Staff, his last job in uniform, he was effectively relieved of duty by Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, because in the run-up to the Iraq War, when the Bush administration was claiming that this would be a quick war, it would require very little troops, then four-star General Eric Shinseki went before Congress and basically said he didn't agree with that, that he thought it would be several hundred thousand troops that would be required to pacify Iraq. It turned out that he was right. History proved him right. But at the time, he was basically cashiered, retired earlier than planned. And I think when Obama appointed him, it was sort of a double message. One, I want a very competent individual who can speak truth to power. But I think at the same time, it was seen, at least in Washington, as kind of a poke in the eye of the previous administration that I'm going to bring this guy into my cabinet.
How could that happen to a Purple Heart Award recipient and a four-star general, the first Japanese-American to become a four-star general?
If you recall, during the Bush administration, there were some leaders at the top who didn't brook a lot of dissent. And I think There was a lot of indication at the time, too, that General Shinseki did not get along very well with Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, and other leaders in the Bush administration. I think he had some differing views than they did, and he, you know, spoke those views mostly behind closed doors. But I think it was a clash of personalities, a clash of views that then came out into the open just weeks before the Iraq invasion back in 2003.
You reported on the Iraq war, Brian. What was Shinseki's reputation among the troops?
General Shinseki, you know, had enormous respect, enormous allegiance throughout the ranks of the Army. He was wounded twice in Vietnam. One of those, he almost lost his foot and effectively was told that it needed to be amputated, thus ending his military career. He insisted on keeping much of his foot and really spent a long time in the hospital, recuperating, rehabilitating himself, and went back into the active duty, which is quite rare, was certainly quite rare in that era, and went on to be a four-star general, very highly respected. As you mentioned earlier, he was the first Japanese-American to reach that rank in the military. And, you know, he used to tell the story that he grew up hearing lots of stories about his uncles who had fought in World War II for the United States, even though they were Japanese-Americans. And he was just sort of this truly American story. And in some ways, you know, the end of his political career is quite American as well. Mm. He presided over an agency that has long had a reputation for management problems. I think he gets a lot of credit for doing some things right at the VA, lowering this backlog of claims, reduced tremendously the number of homeless veterans that are out on the streets. And so I think in the coming days, there will be more discussion about what he actually accomplished, which I think most people think was quite significant. I just think in these recent revelations, it just became clear that he was not the right person to carry the agency forward. Certainly Congress didn't have any confidence that he could do it. And I think it just got to the point where he and the president decided they needed a fresh set of eyes on this.
Brian Bender in Washington with the Boston Globe. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So one man out of a job and another waiting to see what happens next. Speaking of waiting to see what happens next, you may remember a story we featured last month about an unprecedented visit taken by Palestinian university students to the concentration camp memorial in Auschwitz. The group's professor was trying to break taboos about the Holocaust in Palestinian society, but when the group got back, there was uproar. Students demonstrated, the professor got death threats, the university distanced itself, and other teachers kicked him out of the teachers' union. As Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem, the question now is whether he resigns, gets fired, or patches things up.
Mohamed Dejani's trip to Auschwitz was part of a project with Israeli universities. Israeli students visited Palestinian refugees. Dejani says he was researching how those kinds of encounters might create empathy for the opposite side's suffering, something sorely lacking in this conflict. But Dejani says he didn't break any university rules because the trip was unaffiliated with the school. And he says he's not even a member of the union that kicked him out. But he says the message sent by other professors is loud and clear.
I think it was meant to insult. It was meant to humiliate. And so they want to set me as an example in order for people to be afraid to actually think in terms of dialogue with the other or in terms of reconciliation with the other.
Al-Quds University used to be different. It hosted dozens of joint projects with Israeli universities. But in 2008, citing an unending barrage of rocket fire, Israel declared war on Gaza. Palestinian civilians were killed, and the university said no to any new initiatives with Israelis. Other Palestinian universities also shunned cooperation with Israeli academics. It's part of a larger movement in Palestinian society against what's called normalization, collaborating with Israelis as if there's no conflict and relations are normal. Israeli economics professor Eyal Winters thinks the strategy is counterproductive for Palestinians. He used to conduct a behavioral economics study with Al-Quds University using game theory to look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Israel has one of the best academic environment in the world. And just nearby, there are several universities that are craving more support in academia, right? Lectures in scientific collaborators and so forth. And these are being denied from them, and I think it's unfair.
He thinks it's bolstering those Israelis who say Israel doesn't have a partner for peace.
They come up and say, they won't even collaborate with you. How can we reach a peace agreement with these people?
And Israelis point to something else they find troubling. While people like Dejani are denounced, this is welcomed. Students last November staged a rally with masked demonstrators carrying fake weapons next to posters depicting suicide bombers. Whoever sells out his own people is a traitor, go the lyrics to this song. The university-sanctioned demo led Brandeis University in Massachusetts to suspend its own partnership with Al-Quds. Another demonstration like this also happened a few months ago. Al-Quds' incoming president, Imad Abukishik, defends the rallies.
We are representing all levels and all sectors of the Palestinian society. So we have jihad, we have Islamic movement, we have Fatah movement. We are a creating environment of democracy.
He says all Palestinian political views are welcome on campus. But Professor Dejani says professors who believe in joint projects with Israelis are learning their views are not wanted.
Now they are seeing what's happening with me and they are worried about if they would be the next target.
Dejani says a dean at the university was attacked and beaten recently because he runs a joint initiative with an Israeli university. The longtime Al-Quds president, Sari Nusaybeh, was also attacked once for his pro-peace stance. He's quitting. Now the question is, will Dejani stay? Because of all the controversy, he's submitted his resignation. But the incoming university president says he doesn't want Dejani to go, and neither does Dejani.
I have actually already received offers to teach abroad, but I don't want to do that because there is a need for me here much more than any other place, because I can see the impact on my students and how it changed the way they feel and the way they think and their behavior.
He wants university officials to publicly reject his resignation to send a strong signal of support for his freedom of expression. He says if he doesn't hear back by Sunday, he'll leave. He's still waiting for their decision. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
From the ad desk now, the Super Bowl. It's known for the commercials during football's frequent breaks. Soccer doesn't have many breaks, so the commercials to pay attention to this year come before the World Cup. They become epic mini-movies. A certain athletic company has a pretty good one right now, but this week I saw what could be the greatest pre-World Cup ad ever. From a bank in Chile, a country whose team has qualified for the tournament in Brazil, the ad is in Spanish, and I don't understand what's being said, but I don't need to. At first, a lineup of men appears on a barren hill. They look like a team, maybe even the Chilean national team. Then their captain steps up to speak.
En este lugar quedamos atrapados por 70 días.
And you realize he's not a soccer player. He's one of the 33 miners who were trapped underground in Copiapó, Chile, for nearly 70 days back in 2010. And he's delivering an impassioned speech, as you can hear, urging fans to support Chile's World Cup team. Now, you should know that the odds are stacked against Chile at the tournament next month. It's in a so-called group of death, along with reigning world champion Spain and the second-best team from the last World Cup, the Netherlands. Only two teams advance. So what does Mario Sepulveda, the impassioned miner on the screen, say to those impossible odds? He says, we're not scared of the group of death. We don't care about death at all because we already beat death before. It's a heavy dictum for the Chilean team heading to Brazil, and it makes you wonder how the players feel about this. I mean, this ad is basically saying to the team, if the miners won their battle against death, the least you can do is get more balls in the goal than your opponents. As the ad's tagline says, nothing is impossible for a Chilean. Now that's a unique approach. Guilt your national team to victory. You can see this memorable ad featuring the 33 Chilean miners at PRI.org. Still ahead on The World, Code Pink as imagined by Bollywood on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI and supported by TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Here's one thing I learned today. I've got this old pair of tennis shoes made by Converse, Jack Purcell's. Fine, call me a hipster. I always assumed Jack Purcell was a tennis player, but I never did the research. Turns out he's a badminton player, from Ontario. That's what I learned. Too bad a designer hired by the city planners in Canada's capital didn't do their research. We've got Matthew Pearson from the Ottawa Citizen newspaper to explain. I hear this has something to do with a park in Ottawa, right, Matthew?
It does. It has to do with a park which is adjacent to a community center. They're both named after Jack Purcell. Recently, I noticed that there are these sort of tall structures in the park that they looked kind of odd. They're sort of, you know, 5 meters tall, and they have a hoop at the top, and they light up at night. And so I asked around about what they were and learned that they were put in the park inspired by Jack Purcell, who is the famous badminton player. He did win the world championship in 1933, went on to design sneakers for Converse. The only problem, Marco, is that the Jack Purcell for whom the park and community center are named after was actually a different Jack Purcell. He was an Ottawa guy, lived in the neighborhood, and in the 50s was known as the stick doctor because he fixed kids' hockey sticks.
Wow, so two different Jack Purcells. Were you the one who discovered this after asking these questions?
Yeah, I broke the story. I mean, I wasn't the person who pointed it out. What actually happened was a local historian, when the park design was proposed last year, got in touch with the landscape architect and said, I think you've got the wrong Jack Purcell. There is, you know, a file on Jack Purcell, the hockey stick mender for kids at the city's archives. It is him who the park is named for. And so the landscape architect said to me that he went back to the drawing board and came back with what he calls, quote, stylized trees. But to many folks, they still look like badminton rackets. Some people think they look like tennis rackets. And even one person suggested to me that they look like goalposts from the sport Quidditch, which was made famous, of course, in Harry Potter.
Yeah, they certainly don't look like hockey sticks. That's one thing they don't look like.
They don't look like hockey sticks. You're right.
Well, we've got pictures of these badminton rackets at PRI.org, but tell us what the bottom line here was. What did this project cost the city of Ottawa?
The entire park redesign had a budget of $525,000 Canadian, and of that, they installed 10 of these badminton rackets / Quidditch goalposts / stylized tree lights, and each of them cost $4,600. So we're looking at about $46,000 for that. And then the city told me that it spent about $10,000 in wiring and lights and sort of to power them.
That's a lot of money considering somebody just didn't click on the disambiguation button on Wikipedia.
Well, it's a funny thing. I mean, Jack Purcell, the hockey stick mender, sort of lived and died before the internet. So it seems that there has been this confusion about who is Jack Purcell. So the city councillor in whose ward the park is in has said that she'd actually now like to have a plaque put up in the park so we do actually remember who Jack Purcell was, because it was a pretty big deal. Like in 1 year alone, he supplied something like 175 sticks to kids. In those days, it was kind of a poor neighborhood, so he was helping out kids in his neighborhood. He later went on to sharpen skates for them. So he died in 1966, and a couple of years later, when they were getting ready to build this community center, the local residents were very determined that it should be named for him because of his role.
Matthew Pearson with the Ottawa Citizen, thanks very much for your time.
I appreciate it, Marco. Have a good day.
The opera singer we're about to meet was supposed to be performing tonight in Pretoria, South Africa, but his show, Madiba, the African opera, was canceled after just 3 nights because of a lack of funding. The opera is about Nelson Mandela's early years in his native home of Kunu on South Africa's Eastern Cape. Thabang Siyanekal played Mandela in the production. Siyanekal is a well-known baritone in South Africa, and he's disappointed that the show was canceled.
We were all shocked and disappointed at the same time. But we as artists were hoping that this show will go on because it has to be seen by the whole world.
So give us the good stuff from at least the shows that you were able to perform. And what was it like to portray Mandela, and not just Mandela, but a singing Mandela at that?
For me, it was so unbelievable. You know, I went to auditions and I knew I was going to get a role, but one of those small roles. I never thought in a million years that I would get the role of Nelson Mandela. But then when I got the call from the CEO of the company telling me that, Thabang, you got the role of Nelson Mandela. Like, he sent me an email and I couldn't believe it. Like, I couldn't sleep that night because I was so nervous. But then when we started with music, I told myself, you know what, Thabang, this is doable, you can do this. And through the help of the other cast members, it's easy for me to portray the role of Nelson Mandela.
Yeah, so everybody rallied around you to get it right. Where do you even start to prepare for a role like this, especially when you're not even thinking you're going
to
get it?
What I had to do as an artist, like, as you all know, Nelson Mandela is a world icon. So luckily, I knew some things about him, but then I had to dig deep to get the character of the man. Because the story starts when Nelson Mandela was still a child from the rural areas. And the director of the show is related to Nelson Mandela. So he sat me down and told me what he's expecting from me. So for me, it was easy because I got the whole information from the director.
I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to sing just a little something from the opera. Is that possible?
Okay, I will try. I'll try.
In cosa sana ya se mampondo e lì e bisana.
This is one of the aria from the opera.
Brilliant.
So, yeah.
Wow. So yeah. Can you just describe the scene where that aria occurs?
It occurs in the second act, the love scene. So Nelson is singing his song to Winnie Mandela. Like, he's telling the people that when he met Winnie, it was love at first sight.
I mean, considering this opera is about Nelson Mandela's early years, what do you think audiences learn that's new about him and his life then?
Like, most people know Nelson Mandela, like, as a president. They never knew anything about him from the childhood. So I think our audiences have learned a lot out of this opera, because now they knew Nelson Mandela from the childhood, the reason why he had to go away from his village to come to Joburg and look for greener pastures. So I think from that opera, they now know the man who was the world icon.
And Thabang, what's the most important thing you learned about Nelson Mandela after performing in Madiba, the African opera?
What I've learned from the man is that whatever you want to achieve is possible whenever you put your mind on it. Everything is possible.
Thabang Siyanekal, who is a very well-known baritone in South Africa, even better known now. Thanks for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
You know, when people are quoting Maya Angelou's final tweet before she died this week, that Twitter is a thing, a big thing. Now, it's hard to top the lyricism of a great poet in 140 characters, but the world is also on Twitter. We're at PRI The World. I'm there, too, at Marco Werman. Marco like Polo, Werman like Ethel Merman, with a W. It's The World on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on The World, Iceland is a pretty isolated place up there in the North Atlantic. Icelandic singer Asgeir knows this all too well. He's had to deal with it as an artist.
It's hard for bands sometimes to start touring and trying to, you know, get their name outside of Iceland, because you always have to travel so far. And yeah, it can be tough.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. On this program, we sometimes report on some pretty difficult and, yes, at times depressing stories. But I guess the hope is that by covering the difficult issues, we're helping to start a conversation about what needs changing out there in the world. Right now, we're going to try and do that by discussing some horrific attacks against women in India and Pakistan. Those are two very important countries for the U.S. strategically and economically, and in both, the extreme violence against women keeps happening. We heard a lot last year, after that shocking rape and murder in Delhi, about the grim reality many women face in India. But the debate there and the violence continue, as we'll hear in a few minutes. First, let me direct you to Pakistan and writer Beena Shah. She's dealing with another awful story. It involves a woman in Lahore who was beaten to death by her own family after she apparently married the man she loved.
Well, that is what seemed to have happened when the story first broke. We heard that a woman was going to the court in Lahore to testify that she had married her husband out of her own free will. She hadn't been kidnapped, as her family alleged. And as they were going to the court, and they were supposedly protected by police, a group of her own male family members set upon the two, beat him, and bludgeoned her to death with bricks. It's just horrific. We just can't understand how or why this happened.
And not only that, but the police were standing by, people were standing by, and nobody intervened.
The police dispute that they were standing there. They say that they weren't on the scene, arrived quickly, and that she was already dead by the time they got there. And Farzana Parveen's husband, Muhammad Iqbal, says, no, they were there. They were standing. They did nothing. She was begging bystanders for help. They did nothing. And we're talking about a courthouse where there are lawyers and litigants and, you know, educated people there, and yet nobody helped her.
To complicate matters, Bina, I gather the husband who was beaten, Muhammad Iqbal, has admitted that 6 years ago he murdered his first wife in order to marry Ms. Parveen, who was beaten to death. How could he get away with murder?
Well, this is where it all starts to get complicated, Marco. He was forgiven by the family members of his first wife, and there is a loophole in Pakistani laws, which, while it does state that these kinds of killings, euphemistically called honor killings, are against the law, there is a law in Islamic law which allows the families of a murder victim to forgive the killer, and then the murderer goes unpunished.
Are there politicians in the government in Pakistan who recognize this tension between clerics and the state, and who is doing anything about that to make sure that it's a state that has the upper hand in Pakistan?
It's very difficult to make these kinds of distinctions. I would say the people who are raising their voices the most are women's rights activists and sympathetic women lawmakers and politicians. So you see a divide across gender lines. We do have some male allies. For example, Tahir Ashrafi, who's the head of the Pakistan Ulema Council, that is the group of religious leaders that advises the state on religious matters, he issued a fatwa today, an Islamic edict against honor killing, and said that this was completely illegal and completely un-Islamic.
I just don't understand how events like these can happen. In the country that elected a woman, Benazir Bhutto, prime minister, the first woman to ever lead a Muslim state.
Well, look what they did to her.
But that was, do you think that was an honor killing?
No. What I'm saying is that women's lives are not held in great value. So even if Benazir Bhutto was elected the prime minister, that doesn't mean that ordinary women, the women of lower socioeconomic classes, the women who are in the villages of our cities, that doesn't mean that they're going to break out of their chains.
Pakistan seems so critical in global affairs. It's a nuclear state. What do you think's at stake for a nation where this kind of hatred of women just seems to be, I don't know, if not accepted, at least hard to roll back?
Well, I think the entire region of South Asia displays this hatred of women. Patriarchy goes very much hand in hand with the culture of South Asia. And I think that you risk an entire region becoming unstable when you have what is pretty much an undeclared war against half of its population. So I think that in order to bring back stability into the region, we have to look at these just ongoing episodes of violence. They are a real assault on half the population. We have to really put our heads together. This, in a way, for me, is much more important than the issue of nuclear safety and stability or the fight against terrorism. This is the overarching issue for me.
Writer Bina Shah speaking with me from Karachi in Pakistan. Pakistan's neighbor, India, has its own traumatic history with the issue of violence against women, a history that also keeps repeating itself. The top news story today in India is about two teenage girls who were gang-raped in their village and were then hanged from a mango tree. A picture of the girls' bodies hanging from that tree has been circulating on social media sites. But the mainstream media in India is not allowed to publish the photo. I asked Supriya Nair for her take about this tragic story. She's an editor for a magazine called Caravan in New Delhi.
The way I look at it, there are two levels on which we need to approach the problem of pervasive sexual violence in societies like ours. One, of course, is, you know, misogyny at the cultural level and the fact that every woman or every transgender person or every sexual minority has to face, you know, the threat of violence every day in a variety of contexts. The other thing, Marco, I think, particularly given, you know, incidents as violent as these, is to look at the culture of impunity that breeds them. The reason these girls were hung to death after they were raped, much like the young woman in the December 16th bus rape in Delhi was disemboweled, I think was not so much because the perpetrators feared retribution, but simply that they thought that they could get away with doing these things. So there is a law and order problem here that I think we need to focus on in a very sustained way. Perhaps the answer to that is not outrage so much as continued attention.
There was a huge election just wrapped up in India. Was there any discussion of violence against women in any of the debates or political discussion during the campaigns?
I think our elections are as patriarchal as the rest of our society. So when the question of violence against women comes up, particularly in electoral contests that are largely being fought between men, this tends to become, you know, a paternalistic argument about who needs protection and how we're going to protect our women and girls. So there was a lot of lip service paid to the question of violence against women in that respect, but less especially concrete stuff about what we're going to do to ensure that we can protect women's agency and their rights.
Right. And now we have these two girls who were raped and hanged under this tree. Mm-hmm. What has been the reaction, especially after the uproar over the young woman who was killed in December of 2012 in Delhi?
The sort of mass outrage sparked by the December 16th rape had the effect, I think, of gender violence becoming a part of our daily public conversation in India in a way that it wasn't before. So between then and now, there have been several incidents that have caught, if not national attention, then certainly attention in the regions from which they spring. And I think this particular case, the Badayun case, may have been one of those cases that counted sort of in the multitude of these cases that show us that we have a long way to go when it comes to improving our law and order situation and our responsiveness, had it not been for, you know, the unfortunate fact of that illegally circulated photograph, which put a lot of commentators in mind, perhaps inappropriately, of the racial realities of the United States several decades ago. You know, Billie Holiday's song, Blood on the Root, Blood on the Leaves.
Strange fruit, right?
Indeed. I'm not sure we can appropriate that analogy completely, but a lot of people have pointed out that this particular incident shows us that we can not only look at violence of this kind on the axis of gender, but also of caste. These teenagers were Dalits, considered the lowest of the low caste. They were once called untouchables. And the men who've been accused of committing this crime are from a caste, a relatively higher caste, an upwardly mobile caste that has more political power and more economic power. And a great, you know, a big part of the reason why I imagine they thought they could get away with it was simply because institutionally it feels like the authorities are on their side.
What does the conversation sound like between you and your colleagues, your friends, Supriya? Is it just kind of like wrapped up with impatience and the government not doing enough?
I wouldn't say I'm sensing the undercurrent of impatience. I'm also, you know, a metropolitan journalist. I'm relatively privileged. And in this case in particular, I think there's a sense of how vast the gap is even between, you know, groups of women in India, women like me and, you know, women like those teenagers who simply went out into the fields that night because they needed to relieve themselves, incidentally, because, you know, there are no toilets in their home, which I think is a key sort of infrastructural point that deserves more discussion. I suppose it's a question now for journalists like me to assess how we might be able to build and contribute to a public conversation in which we are able to listen to the voices of marginalized women like these and to make sure that help arrives at the right time when it's required.
Supriya Nair, Associate Editor for the magazine Caravan in New Delhi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As we just heard, there are many different views on gender equality in India, and advocates are pushing for change in many different ways. That includes an unexpected hit movie from Bollywood. Queen tells the story of a young Hindu woman whose fiancé leaves her on the eve of their wedding. But rather than let that ruin her life, she sets off on a charming adventure of self-discovery. Reporter Megan Williams caught the film in New Delhi.
The movie Queen doesn't start out well. After a night of pre-wedding celebration with her family, the fresh-faced protagonist Rani, played by Kangana Ranaut, is dumped by her fiancé. But Rani, or Queen in English, has worked hard to pay for her honeymoon. So, to the surprise of her traditional Hindu family, she embarks for Europe on a solo trip, her first ever. A string of charming and hilarious encounters follows. And when her fiancé finally catches up with her to win her back.
I love you, Rani.
Well, let's just say Rani is no longer the girl he left. Made for less than $2 million, Queen pulled in four times that amount in its first 2 weeks. Rapid-fire word of mouth made it the first female-centered comedy to be a box office hit in India. The Bollywood movies that pull in the big money tend to feature male heroes who get the girl. Stories that appeal to male audiences in a country where many women still don't feel comfortable going to movies on their own. But women have turned out in droves for this one. Outside a late showing of Queen in Delhi, the mainly female audience is gushing.
It makes us feel really happy after the movie. When you watch a movie, you want to get entertained, you want to feel happy. Not a typical Bollywood movie. It's different. Yeah, it was like rediscovering herself.
Freedom of a girl, what a girl thinks about the freedom. She has never been so free towards the world. She got an opportunity to see the world.
The ending is telling us that we are free to do whatever we want, but we need to realize that we have the right to freedom too.
Which is a really empowering message, because the way Indian society is structured, life is really about getting married.
Advaita Kala is a Bollywood screenwriter, columnist, and author of Almost Single, the first chick lit novel in India.
And you're not assumed to be living a complete or a full life as a woman if you're not married by a certain age. People constantly ask you, are you getting married? When are you getting married? Are you married? Why are you not married? These questions sort of follow you around no matter what you achieve in life.
Kala says it's next to impossible to get a script with a female heroine greenlit by Indian producers. They understand profits lie in rowdy Bollywood movies that pull in repeat audiences of young men. Kala says what makes Queen's success all the more extraordinary is that it falls outside the cliched narratives of women as one-dimensional objects of fantasy or superheroes overcoming amazing odds.
It was about female empowerment, but it was stated in very non-heroic and realistic terms, So she wasn't that she was going through some extraordinary crisis in her life that brought this out in her. I mean, she was just going through a personal crisis. She got dumped a few days before her wedding. And it's how she turned her life around and set herself free in so many ways. And that is really what appealed to a lot of young women and women who watched that movie here.
Kala says it's also a rare Indian movie in which the female lead is allowed to be funny. Queen hasn't just won the hearts of Indians. It's clearly a story that resonates far and wide. Remakes in Tamil, Telugu, and Chinese are now in the works, giving more women around the world a chance to see stories of their everyday lives on the big screen. For The World, I'm Megan Williams in New Delhi, India.
There's another recent Bollywood film featuring strong women as central characters, and it's very different from Queen. This one is full of action scenes featuring women warriors carrying sticks and fighting men. It's called Gulab Gang, and it's about a group of vigilante Indian women dressed in pink saris. They beat up men who commit crimes against women and other social injustices. The film is actually a comeback for former Bollywood starlet Madhuri Dixit. This is a big departure from her previous song and dance-filled romantic hits. For this role, she had to train in martial arts to prepare for those fighting scenes. The movie is said to be based on a real-life group in northern India. You can check out the action-packed trailer by visiting our Facebook page at facebook.com/PRI The World. This is The World from PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, and this is Ásgeir Trausti. He's from Iceland, and he's got a new CD out called In the Silence. You'll get the chance to see Ásgeir when he plays a few dates in the U.S. next month. In the meantime, just listen to this taste of a command performance he gave The World.
Home, I'm making my way home. My mind's already there. Yes, my mind is light. You're with me in the dark. Light my way. Your light shine out. This burden weighs me down. The heaviest of weights knocks me to the ground. Right down to the tomb.
Performing for us exclusively there, Ásgeir Trausti, better known simply as Ásgeir. He was playing for us in New York. And Ásgeir, tell us who was with you. I know you're usually a solo artist. Who was accompanying you there?
Julius Robertson. And he wrote a few lyrics on the album In the Silence that we made.
And what a beautiful album it is. You're from Iceland. When you sing that song, Going Home, is there a place you think of specifically?
Just home for me, where we both of us grew up. It's in the northwest side. And it's a town called Laugarbakki, and Julius grew up in the same area, but he grew up in a farm, and I was in this small village, and yeah, we started playing together a few years ago.
Now, when I've gone to Iceland, my sense is when I land in Reykjavik is that even though I'm pretty close to Europe, I feel about as far as I can get from everything in the world. Is that contrast as evident for people like yourself who grow up and live in Iceland?
Yeah, we are pretty far from everything, you know. It takes us 2-hour flight to get somewhere. It's pretty isolated, I would say. And yeah, it's hard for bands sometimes to start touring and trying to, you know, get their name outside of Iceland, because you always have to travel so far. And yeah, it can be tough.
Now, this is not your first album, In the Silence. You're actually pretty popular in Iceland. Not unusual for your music to chart in the top five. Last few singles of yours have hit number one. There's a single called, I'm going to probably butcher this, Frá mér til ykkur. Is that right?
Yeah, Frá mér til ykkur, you know.
And yeah. But it's not on your new album, In the Silence, but it was released this year.
Yeah, we just recorded the song a few weeks back and getting some radio play back home.
Yeah, like maybe even number 2 or number 1 now.
Yeah.
Frá mér til ykkar, æði löng er leiðin. Lífið næðir gegnum dagrin.
So that song obviously is in Icelandic, but all the songs on In the Silence are in English. Do you write in English or do you translate afterwards from Icelandic?
Well, up until now, we've just made this one album. And In the Silence, we made an album in Icelandic back in 2012, which was called Týri Döðaþögn. And then we translated the whole album. That's In the Silence. And that was released worldwide. So I've just done, you know, one album up until now. And the process has always been, you know, writing the Icelandic lyrics first and then we translate into English most of the time. So we haven't done that much. We just started, you know, 2 years ago.
That's pretty extraordinary. I've never heard of an artist doing that, where they record an album and then a couple of years later basically redo the whole thing in a different language.
Yeah, it's not usual, but we wanted to do an English version of the album and try to get it out of Iceland. And yeah, we were just so lucky that the labels showed this interest and wanted to help us.
I mean, a cynical person would say, of course you would do this. The music is great. Why not put it in a language that more people could access?
Yeah, I think that's a big reason for it. And I definitely think we wouldn't have gotten this success outside of Iceland if we hadn't, you know, translated the album. And, you know, the lyrics are the same. Those are the same lyrics, but, you know, it's just another language.
I mean, I didn't know your music before this album. And this question occurred to me when I heard your music. And I imagine a lot of people who have heard In the Silence have wondered this. Why isn't your music better known? So are you hoping that by putting your music into the English language, this will take you to the next level?
Well, we recorded this English version like in the beginning of 2013. And yeah, we've been traveling ever since. And we just released this here in the US and we're just starting to tour here and just signed to a label here. And so things are looking good, I think.
Well, I know the crowd's going to be wanting to hear one song that you do called King and Cross. It's one of the singles on In the Silence. And you'll take us out with that, Asgeir. Really great to meet you. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. You too.
Glistening night, time to. And she is walking with me from the house of red. I hear a child crying for his heading home. Their prayings from their jaws and the forest knows. But it won't share the secret when the king takes sides, leaving mortal minds. Soldiers take their share. Nidhogg seems to sense that inside them burns the raging fire of life. He'll take back what he owns. Death cannot.
Asgeir, along with Julius Robertson and an exclusive performance of the song King and Cross. That's all for us this week. Eric Goldberg composed our theme tune. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back Monday, and here's some more Asgeir to take you into the weekend.
Southern winds, I found my strength now when nobody knows. And we must keep their secret when the king takes sides, leaving mortal minds. Soldiers take their share. Nidhogg seems to sense.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. The Ford Foundation, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall.
PRI, Public Radio International.